Thank you very much. I appreciate the introduction, the opportunity to be here. And I actually appreciate having heard some of your, forgive me for lack of a better word, housekeeping matters being discussed. Because it gives me a sense, a flavor of what's going on here. And I must tell you, it's very impressive. Specifically, the delicate concern for the individuals and where they're holding and what their problems may be, and the systems that it seems you've put in place to make these things happen. And I think it's an amazing thing. I wish it was more prevalent in the world of chinuch. I'm not sure that it is. And it makes me feel here that coming here, my greatest qualification to have time with you this morning is that I have many more years of mistakes having been made in chinuch, probably than many people here put together. And if we learn from our mistakes, then we can become qualified on that basis. So with that in mind, I'd like to share with you some ideas and encourage your participation and discussion. I think that, first of all, today, we have achieved an amazing level of success. The extent, the numbers, the accomplishments of the Moistis HaTorah are truly phenomenal. I mean, wherever you go, I just came back from St. Louis last Shabbos. They have a beautiful yeshiva there, high school, and a building, by the way, the campus, which I never saw before, you know, like it's not real. And this is all over. And Baruch Hashem, we have seen success that 50 and 60 and 70 years ago, no one could have dreamt of in this country. Maybe there were a few dreamers, but everybody thought they were just that, dreamers. And Baruch Hashem, it's reality. But with success, and sometimes even due to the success, come a lot of challenges and problems that we face. And today, I think that we face a serious problem that I like to try to define in one word, and that is the problem of reaching our Talmidim. We have many Talmidim to teach. We have many wonderful teachers, dedicated, committed, Moser Nefesh, capable, knowledgeable, who are there teaching, and they are teaching. And for the most part, the teaching is going well. But how deeply, how passionately, and how long-reachingly, forgive me if there's no such word, are we really reaching our students? And that cannot be told in the early stages. That cannot even be clearly seen in the high school years. Because today, we have two phenomena which are plaguing our communities. Literally plaguing our communities. The one, of course, of teenagers, is to call them at risk now. They're already more than at risk. They're off the derech in numbers that are staggering. And there's another phenomenon which is taking place now, and that is adults that are going off the derech. Adults, some, and I deal with some of these situations, that are still learning in Koyla, but going off the derech, believe it or not. It's an amazing, it's a mind-boggling phenomenon. How could it be? But we haven't necessarily succeeded in reaching our students with a lasting and permanent, passionate commitment, knowledgeable, a deep-rooted commitment intellectually and emotionally to Yahadut. And that, I think, is a serious issue. And basically, that's the issue that I would like to try to address today. And I think addressing that issue in the earliest stages of their education can sometimes be the most critical ingredient. I had some of, you know, you have moments of nachas in your life. And I know a number of times where I've met people and they've told me that your daughter was my teacher in the fifth grade. And because of that, look at me today. This is who I am. Fifth grade. You know how many years went by since fifth grade? You know how many exposures went by since fifth grade? You know how many challenges went by from fifth grade? You know how many good teachers this individual, and there were a number of them that I've heard over the years, were exposed to in since fifth grade? But sometimes that root, and it's not just the fifth, it could be the fourth and the third, it could be even earlier. And it plants in a pure and fertile mind and heart the seeds that can grow into a permanent structure, into a permanent tree, into a tree so strong that no wind, that no hurricane, no avalanche can uproot it. And that's really what we would like to do. I think, just to put it in perspective, a word about the definition of chinuch. We actually read it in the parasha last Shabbos, when the Torah tells us about Avraham Avinu vayorekes chanichov. So Rashi defines chanichov miloshen chinuch. And he, in short, defines chinuch as tchilas knisas, or hascholas knisas odom, or keli, he says, leumnes sheosid lamud bo. It's the beginning of the entry, not even the entry, the beginning of the entry to an umnes, to a profession or a trade or a lifestyle that this individual is destined to maintain, to life. Chinuch is an introduction, is a beginning of an entry into a lifelong commitment. And that, I think, is a critical perspective, a critical background, a critical context to have. It's lifelong. The goal is lifelong. The goal is not to get through the year, and sometimes that's hard enough, but the goal is to inspire a lifelong commitment. And whatever ingredients that we can put inside to inspire that lifelong commitment, we have succeeded in an enormous dimension. But there's also something else. It's tchilas knisas. What does that mean? I think what that means is that the rest of the knisa, they're going to have to do on their own. We're just beginning the process, which means we have to give them tools. They need tools to be able to do this. They need that sense of permanence. It's for the future. It's to remain. But the way it's going to remain is that they now have tools to be able to continue. If they can't read, we find terrible, terrible trouble later on. If they have some difficulty with certain aspects of observance of mitzvot, then later on it interferes with their life. We have to give them the tools of reading, the tools of thinking, the tools of understanding, the tools of appreciation, the ability to see what they're doing and why they're doing it, and in a way to do it that fits for them and works for them and makes sense for them. And when we prepare them to be able to continue to grow on their own, we have set them on the path for permanence, which should really be the goal of the entire chinuch system. That having been said, I'd like to talk for a few moments about what I believe is maybe the most critical ingredient in chinuch, and maybe the most critical ingredient in life itself. And that, in one word, put, is happiness. Happiness. And happiness is a very, very strange phenomenon in our society. Besides the fact that we are guaranteed in our Constitution the right for the pursuit of happiness, and besides the fact that our society today, maybe more than in previous generations, maybe they had it more in previous generations, is pursuing happiness. More money is spent in the pursuit of happiness than anything else in the world. More seminars, more lectures, more books, more self-help, more consultations with mental health professionals, all in the name of the pursuit of happiness. Everyone's pursuing happiness. Everyone wants to be happy. You ask a group of people, what do you want more than anything else? And after the jokers with the money and the COVID and the pleasure and the this come up, everybody wants to be happy. That's really what we want. So we have a world pursuing happiness. And if you judge by any of the rates out there, we don't seem to be too successful. Suicide rates, divorce rates, substance abuse rates, rates that mental health professionals charge. It doesn't seem to be a very happy place, this world. Why? It doesn't make sense. So much pursuit of happiness and so little success. And I have a theory that the reason for this is that we don't know what we're looking for. If you don't know what you're looking for, you can't find it. You could trip on it and you wouldn't even know it. What is happiness? Worse than that, more serious for our society is, our society has given us a definition of happiness. Our society has given us an equation for happiness. And that equation is not only wrong, it's just the opposite. And that is, what's the equation? Pleasure equals happiness. That's the equation. Have a good time. Have pleasure, indulge, more pleasure, more pleasure, this pleasure, that pleasure, all pleasures, every pleasure, all the time. Pleasurize yourself from day to night, and you'll be happy. And unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the reality, even though society is teaching us that. And to the contrary, it seems that the more pleasure we provide in our society, the less happy we find people to be. And I'd like to try to offer a possible suggestion why. David HaMelech said, Achas shoalti me'eis Hashem oiso avakesh. Shivti be'beis Hashem kol yemei chayai. David HaMelech wanted one thing more than anything else. To sit be'beis Hashem. What did David HaMelech say about one who sits be'beis Hashem? Ashrei yoshvei be'secho. Ashrei, osher, seems to be one of, if not the highest form of happiness. We know in the Lashon HaKodesh, the Shirish, the three-letter Shirish of the word, defines the concept. In English and other languages, a table is a table because people decided to call it a table, and a chair is a chair because people decided to call it a chair, and so forth and so on. Not so Lashon HaKodesh. In the Lashon HaKodesh, the three-letter Shirish describes the essence of the concept. I believe that the Shirish of Osher is Ishur, validation. Happiness is about feeling good about myself. If I feel good about myself, I'm happy. Everything's great. If I feel good about myself, I'm not dependent upon all the outside pleasures. I don't constantly need to refill and refill and refill these pleasures of the world and pleasureize myself day and night. Because I feel good about myself. I don't have that void that needs to be filled at every moment of my waking day because I feel good about myself. Now, if that's true, then pleasure is antithetical to happiness because the more I'm dependent on outside infusions, the more it sends me the message that I don't feel good about myself. Oh, I need this and I need that. I need the other thing. I need this drink. I need this food. I need this pleasure. I need this fun. I need this thrill. That means I can't live with myself. I have this void, this insatiable void that has to be filled all day and all night. And this is a real serious issue. And therefore, I think the first thing is to recognize that we have to be able to create circumstances to make our students feel good about themselves. If they feel good about themselves, they're not running any place. They're here to stay. Life is great. They're open-minded. They care. They listen. They're in a different world. They're not distracted by everything, at least to a great extent. But something more than that. If I make them feel good about themselves, that I become the most important person in their lives. Because I've given them the most coveted feeling, the feeling that they want more than anything else. And therefore, I have untold influence on my Talmidim. So I believe that a goal, a major goal of a Rebbe, of a Mechanech, is to create an environment where the students, through his efforts, will be feeling good about themselves. They will then be receptive. He will be influential. Whatever he tells them will be meaningful. They will want to forge a kesher with him. They will be ready to be mekabel what he teaches them. Because this mechanech, this Rebbe, has become the person who makes me feel good about myself, who grants me the most important feeling and possession that I have in my life. How do we do that? How do we make Talmidim to feel good about themselves? In order that, number one, they be receptive to learning, they feel good and they're ready to accept and to accomplish, and that we become that influence that can influence them in so many directions with such a lasting and powerful influence, because we are such a critical ingredient in their happiness. I would like to suggest that, surprisingly enough, there's an ingredient that the Rambam mentions. I think it's in Perek Hey of Hilchos Talmud Torah, next to last halacha there. He says, "Kishem sheha Talmid, the Talmidim, are chayovim lechabed es horav, kach horav tzorich lechabed es Talmid." We, as Rebbeim, have to respect our students. Some people say, of course, it's bullshit. Some people say, what are you talking about? For a while, there was a question going around whether if a Rebbe did something wrong, insulted or something, a Talmud, whether he should ask forgiveness. Like that was a very big question. Like, how could you ask Mechila if you're a Rebbe? How could you not if you're a human being and you did something wrong? But the Rambam, what's that? No, people were talking in amongst Machanchim at one of these conventions. So, but the point is like this. The Rambam says beferish, that a Rebbe is mechuyev, is tzorich. He says, just as the Talmidim are mechuyev to be mechabed the Rebbe has to be mechabed to me. And I'd like to suggest for a moment that there's a very powerful, profound influence in this. Why? Because if the goal is happiness, I want my Talmidim to be happy. And if the definition of happiness is feeling good about myself, when I am respected, that makes me feel good about myself. Why am I respected? Oh, I must be choshev. I must be worthy. And that gives a sense of feeling good about myself. How can we respect Talmidim? Respect is a universal thing. We have to respect someone in every dimension, in every aspect of his existence. I respect his time. Respecting his time means that I'm not the only person in the world that he has to deal with. I'm not the only homework assignment that he gets. I'm not the only test that he may be having, and the only study opportunity or necessity that he may have. I respect his time. I respect his feelings. I respect his questions. Do you know one of the worst things that we get is when we have Talmidim that feel their questions are not listened to, their questions are not respected, their questions are not appreciated, their questions are not encouraged, their questions may not even be permitted, their questions may even be insulted. We don't ask such questions over here. Anyone who asks such a question over here doesn't belong here. That's respect, and that's disrespect. And we have such an opportunity, just like now, there are stupid questions, and there are bad questions, and there are cynical questions, and there are questions that are obviously intended to cause trouble. But we have to find the way to deal with all of them. Sometimes a question is inappropriate for a classroom setting. So you say, that's a very good question. That's an important question, whatever you want to say. Maybe not be good, but maybe important. I understand that concern that you have. But we can't discuss it here in the class. I'll be very happy to talk with you about it privately, and we must do so. There are questions that we don't know the answer to. And by the way, You don't have to know the answer to every question. I'll never forget Reb Chaskel Abramsky, Zichrono Livracha, who was Bizmano Yidi, Godel Hador. He told me once, he says, when he came to London, he was a young man. The previous dayan there had touted him as this goyin and, you know, this genius. And the Rosh HaKol comes the first day to ask him a question. And he answered him, I don't know the answer. And the Rosh HaKol was extremely perturbed. And he calls back to the dayan who had pushed this in, Rabbi Abramsky in. And he said, what did you send us here? What this? He doesn't know the answer to a simple question. And the Rav was very disturbed. He calls up Rabbi Abramsky and he says, Hayitochen, you don't know the answer to such a simple question? He says, of course I know the answer. He says, the first lesson that the Jews of London have to learn is that the rabbi doesn't have to know all the answers. That's true. A rabbi doesn't have to know all the answers. But he has to take the question seriously and he has to say, we'll look into it. I'll find out. I'll do some research. I'll discuss it with some of my colleagues. But take it seriously. Because taking it seriously shows respect, elevates this person's self-confidence, self-image, self-validation, makes him feel good about himself, and makes me a very important, if not the most important, influence in this person's life. And sometimes, even saying, it's a very good question, gets a lot of traction, a lot of mileage. Because, you know, some people ask questions because they want to know answers. Some people ask questions because they want the recognition of asking a good question. So the minute you say, hey, that's a good question, they don't even care about the answer. And it doesn't matter whether you know the answer anymore. Because, yes? What's that? If I say that you can't ask a question now, what level of hypocrisy am I practicing? Yeah, go ahead. So, just loud, it's hard for me to hear.
I have one boy in class who his understanding is very, very shallow. And when I'm teaching a yoga mantra, he's so confused that he starts throwing out questions and he has no idea what he's even saying. And when I try to bring out the clarification and I try to say, what do you need to ask? And then he just like, falls apart and he's like, no, I don't really know. So that's what
See, that's the problem with allowing questions. They usually start off with a question that you can't answer, you know, and then you strike out before you even begin. So that's a rough one. It really is. And unfortunately, it happens all the time. It happens all the time. There are always such students. So, you know, one of the things that I think that has worked effectively over the years for machanchim is to maybe get such a student some preparation before you begin the lesson, let's say on a new piece of Gemara. So maybe on a one-on-one level, they have at least a little bit of an idea of what's going on. Agav, I think it's very important to note, and I'm really glad that you brought it up, because I might have forget to mention it. You know, over the years, they've called us every name in the book, except one name. You never heard the title Stupid Jew. It's interesting. Every name in the book they've called us Stupid Jew. Most kids are not really stupid. Most Jewish kids are not really stupid. They have different learning styles. They have certain confusions. They don't have background information. They don't have the groundwork. They have a skewed way of looking at things. But there's something there. And therefore, some type of personal help, whether the Rebbe can do it himself or whether he has to get some help preparing this student for the class, at least giving him on his level with his interaction, with his questions till he gets it that, hey, this is what we're talking about at least. So that may be able to help. That's one thing. I'm sorry, go ahead. Okay, thank you. Anyway, I got to be very careful. What?
I anticipated that there would be a lot of questions. That would be great. And maybe if Rabbi Cohn could just finish giving the share,
Okay, but in the segment about questions, I think I must do this, okay? Okay. Yeah, go ahead. A piece of advice. Ooh.
In should have gone back and was giving it in the worship. Somebody asked a question that was way off base, and he took the question and he said, such a question, what do you mean to say? And he twisted the whole question inside out and he made it into the Marshal's question, and he made this person feel mamish like he was a Rashkabah.
Yeah, so
the question the person asked.
So I have a similar experiences, and I have such a talent to do that too. But you know what my Talmidim tell me? Come on, I didn't say that. You're just trying to make me feel good. So I would say the difference is like this. In a shir, which is a one-time thing, which is a balabos, you know, that's a very good thing. But in terms of Talmidim in the classroom, number one, you really want to straighten them out. He didn't ask the Marshal's question. You want to get him to think better. And second of all, if you do that all the time, the smart kids in the class say, this Rebbe, come on, cut it out. Who you think you're fooling, you know? So it works both ways. Anyway, but I think that's one. The other thing I think is that sometimes you can tell a person, listen, that's a question. I understand where you're coming from. You don't have to say it's a great question. I understand where you're coming from. But right now, I think that I can't go into that. It's a little bit complicated. And it is complicated because you've got to start from the beginning, from before the beginning, to straighten his mind out to be able to see what you're talking about. And I'll be happy to discuss that with you after class. And I think if you work these two things by getting him a little preparation before, and sometimes take the question and say, I understand that's a good point, but it's an important point, that's a better word, but it's complicated, and it is complicated to explain to him. I'll be happy to sit with you for a few moments after class, and you know. But I wouldn't give up on those students, because I have found over the years that there are many people that push it, people wrote off as stupid. And it's not true. And if we believe in them, and we try to find that unique thinking that they have, which may be backwards, maybe upside down, maybe twisted, but we can often reach them and help them too. Okay, let's continue. So we talked about respect. Let me talk about something else for a moment too, which may be a little harder, maybe a little easier than respect. And that is love. Love validates. Friendship validates. Because the Sipurnu says in the Hakdoma to Shir HaShirim, what is the definition of love? Sheyismach ha'oyhev b'malas ha'ne'av. One who loves rejoices in the qualities of the one that he loves. Which means that if I love you, I have identified in you quality to the extent that I rejoice in those qualities because I see them as so beautiful, as so great, as so off the charts. Memela, love communicates validation. Now, in this situation, I believe machanchim are in a better position than parents. I'll tell you why. Parents love. First of all, today, you should know, kids are not so sure their parents love them. In my day, when I was a kid, we believed that our parents lived for us. Ask your students how many believe that their parents live for them. It's how could you say they live for that? They're busy, they're this, they're always on the phone. Every time I'm talking to them, they're looking at their cell phone, they're listening to this, they're doing 1,001 things. We don't feel that way anymore. And so we're not sure. And we live in a society where sort of the pirud between parents and children is so great that kids really are not confident in that love, and that causes many problems. And besides all of that, if my mother loves me, it's like my grandmother loves me. Like, what else is new? She's programmed for that. It's genetic. She gets paid for that. That's her job. It doesn't mean anything great in terms of my validation. A Rebbe loves me. A Rebbe feels close to me. A Rebbe has a relationship with me. A Rebbe has this... Seems that with this Rebbe, I remember my fondest moment is when I revisited Los Angeles after having been there for many years. And we had, at least in the early days in Los Angeles, I'm talking about in the 70s, it was a midbar shmoma. And the kids that we dealt with there were like, wow, you know, make today's kids look like amateurs. And one of the first graduates met him a few years later, and he says, you know, when we were seniors, and these were a bunch of tough kids who would believe that they could even care less. He says, you know what we used to argue about? Who's the one that has the closest relationship with Rabbi Cohen? was shocked. That's what they talked about. I know they talked about other things too. I'm not fooling myself. But that was, who cares about relationship with the Rebbe? Oh, it's very precious to them. When they feel the relationship with the Rebbe cares about them, it creates a different sense of feeling good about myself, because why should the Rebbe care about me? I must be choshuv. I'll never forget one of the most beautiful experiences I had in my early years in the Chofetz Chaim Yeshiva, when Rabbi Scheinberg was still the mashgiach there. It was an Erev Yom Kippur, and some boy in the yeshiva calls him up, says, I'm very sick, I have a high fever, but I want to go to shul in Yom Kippur, and it's going to be raining, can I wear shoes? No, whatever, I don't know what he told him, that's not relevant. Moitzoy Yom Kippur, he gets a call from Rabbi Scheinberg, asking him, how are you feeling? It left an indelible impression for life. He wasn't sick, he wasn't deathly ill, he wasn't in the hospital, he had a fever, big deal, you know? But that the Rebbe cares. I must be choshuv. And not only that, not only does it have a power to validate, but it has a power to influence. And I share this with you as an example, as a proof. When Yaakov Avinu was confronted by Esav approaching him with 400 soldiers, a year of Ayetzel, Yaakov was concerned. He split up his family to four groups. Esav is coming with 400 soldiers. Yaakov has his four wives and 11 children, very vulnerable. Then he sends a delegation to Esav, and he says, he gives him tzoyin ubokim lofan garti v'oili tzoyin ubokor v'chulei v'chulei. The Ralbag in the Toelius, at the end of each parsha, the Ralbag has Toelius benefits we learn from the parsha. He says, you learn how to melt the heart of an enemy. Show him friendship. Show him friendship. If you show an enemy friendship, it has a melting effect. You can influence him. He's coming to kill you, but it can put everything on hold. But when you think about it, it's truly amazing. Esav's hatred for Yaakov was intense. Chazal say that Esav's hatred created a choik in the Bria. Halocha hi Esav seine li Yaakov. He passed it down to this very day. And Esav believed that Yaakov was a trickster. Vayakveni zeh pa'amayim. He fooled me with the pchayra. He fooled me with the brachas. He's fooling me now. I'm here with 400 soldiers. He's here with 400 soldiers. I'm here with my four wives and my little, I don't know how big they were, but my 11 children. And he's, so I tricked him. I sent him a couple of behemoths. Big deal. And I say, I'm low and guarantee you. I didn't tell him any personal secrets. The Ralbag says that even the suffix of love, it must have been real, I guess. It was something genuine there. He felt some brotherly love. But the suffix can melt the heart of the ultimate enemy. A suffix, maybe the Rebbe cares about me. He's treating me nicely. He takes an interest in me. He makes an extra call when I'm out. He makes sure that I get the assignment. I told him about a problem that my mother had yesterday, and 2 days later he asked me, what happened? How did it go? How did it work? Maybe, I don't know. Maybe he was taught that in Rebbe school. Maybe he went to some kind of a class and they told him to do these things. But maybe he cares. Maybe he feels for me. Maybe he's my friend. Maybe he loves me. That can melt the ultimate resistance. Imagine if we had a formula to melt resistance. Can I ask a question? Is there anyone here who ever has resistance in the classroom? Don't even bother to answer that question. Okay? We all have resistance. Sometimes everybody's resistance. Sometimes certain individuals' resistance. Sometimes certain individuals are always resistant. And others are sometimes resistant. There's always resistance. Love melts resistance. If it could melt resistance of Esav, it can melt anyone's resistance. And I believe that the formula is because it validates. It shows, I must be choshev. And you are making me feel choshev. You have the entree to my heart. And forgive me. Let's see if you have to forgive me in a moment. But here it is. Quote, educating the mind without educating the heart is no education at all. Aristotle said that. goes back a long time ago, but sometimes we forget the heart. We have to find ways to reach the heart. Respect and love reach the heart, melt the heart, create receptivity, remove barriers, and allow us to enter and to become the most influential individual in the lives and the futures of our Talmidim. But there's something else. And forgive me for belaboring this, but I believe that this is probably the most critical ingredient. There's something else. And that is, how can I feel good about myself if I have no purpose? How can I feel good about myself if I don't know what my purpose is? It's clear to me that a good mental health professional, if someone walks into his office and says, I have no purpose in living, that he should recommend or begin some type of suicide watch. Because a person with no purpose to live, why should he live? And I believe the understanding of that is, because if I have no purpose, I can't feel good about myself. How can I feel good about myself? No matter what I have money, I have pleasure, I got this, I got everything. But I don't feel a sense of tachlis. What am I living for? What's the point of it all? And I believe that's why life is so cheap in the 21st century. Because since, and forgive me, but since Darwin came along, Darwin removed the sense of purpose. What do I mean? I'll tell you what I mean. Let me tell you a story, a piece of history that never happened, okay? There was once a Jewish entrepreneur, and he had an idea. And he approached his friend, who was a scientist, and he said to him like this. He says, if you can come up with a theory that can make man into an accident, then we can cash in and we'll become super wealthy. Well, the scientist friend was Darwin. He came up with that theory. He says, we're all here by accident. Forgive me for oversimplifying the theory of evolution, but that's what it is. We're here, we're all one big accident. That's all. Believe it or not, this beautiful group of people here, really, we're all here by accident. Fine. If we're by accident, by definition, there's no purpose. Accident, if you look at the definition, is a purposeless act. We are here by accident. We weren't created. Creation is an act of purpose. When there is a creation, then there's a purpose. When there is an accident, there's no purpose. So Darwin made them into accidents, and the entrepreneur, if you didn't guess, was Freud. And he said, everyone's going to be depressed now because they have no purpose. We'll medicate them, we'll psychoanalyze them, we'll make billions, trillions, who knows what? And of course, this never happened. But I do believe Darwin is guilty. And I'll tell you why. Until Darwin came along, the world kim'at, everyone believed there was a creation. How else did we get here? Until he came along with this bizarre idea that we're here by accident. Everyone knew there was a creator. Most people didn't know who he was, didn't know where he was, didn't know the purpose for which he created the world. But they were searching, they had hope. I spend my life searching for my purpose. Maybe by the end I'll find it. There's a hope of happiness. There's not necessarily happiness, but there's happiness enough to know that there is a purpose because there was a creation. And there's hope enough to say that maybe I'll find a purpose. There was, there is a Klal Yisrael, and many people copied that. You know, most of the major religions copied from Klal Yisrael, who knew the purpose because it was revealed to them by the Creator himself, Maimon Har Sinai. Fine. But came along this guy and says, nah, no purpose. If there's no purpose, if we're by accident, there's no purpose. If there's no purpose, what is the point to live? Life is cheap. It doesn't pay to live. I see many communities where I drive. There are people that walk across the street. You could see almost clearly that they couldn't care less if they die or not. They couldn't care less. They walk. They don't even look. Because what's the difference? Like, what's the point of living anyway? Without purpose, there is no tachlis. What am I here for? And life is not easy. There may not be purpose, but there are problems. And there are challenges, and there are pains, and there are tragedies, and there are difficulties. Without purpose, it's unbearable. And that's why the world, I believe, is such an unhappy place today. So we not only have to give the respect and the love to our students in order to validate them and make them feel good about themselves, we have to give them a sense of purpose. But we're so fortunate in that vein. We're so fortunate in that vein. No one else on this planet has the manual which tells us the purpose for everything in life. The manual is the only way I know that this is not just a head scratcher. This has a purpose. Nobody has a manual that was given to them by the manufacturer himself in a public forum in front of millions of eyewitnesses, an entire nation, so that they could know clearly that this is in fact the manual from the Creator, from the manufacturer himself. And the manufacturer, not only did he speak to the entire nation publicly, but he spoke publicly to the teacher, to the mentor, to the Novi, to the Rebbe, who's going to continue to give, and he's going to teach him all the details of this manual. And he spoke publicly. Only Klal Yisrael has that. Do you know what a precious Yerusha that is? We can be confident that we know the purpose that we are here. And if I could be confident that I know the purpose that I'm here, I could be truly happy. Because my life has purpose. My life has meaning. My life is worth living. My life isn't cheap. And that's why in the world today, without a sense of purpose, life has become very cheap. In the world of Klal Yisrael, life is precious. Kol ha-mekayim nefesh achas mi Yisrael ki'ilu ki'im oyla mole. Because every life has a purpose. We can fulfill the ultimate purpose of creation. So I believe that it's very important that in the Torah that we teach, they have to get the sense of purpose. But the sense of purpose has to be gotten on a number of levels. There is a purpose. There was a creation. What is the purpose? And we have the purpose given to us in a way that we can be confident that this is, in fact, the true purpose. And this, of course, is a major parsha in terms of chinuch, and I'd just like to talk about it for a moment. I brought along some material to give out to you. I was told it's here. There's a box of it, so I don't need it. No, but where is it? I just want to take one thing from it. It's gone already. Look at that. Wow. Oh, here it is. I got it. Sorry about that. I didn't mean to accuse anyone falsely. No, I'm not there. I learned from experience, if I give them out, you'll be reading this and not paying any attention, so I'll give it out later. I have a copy for everybody here, two of these things. This is a very interesting little work. It's called Torah Min HaShemayim. First, a little background. I wrote this many years ago, and one of my kids, when they were growing up, just around starting to use a computer a little bit, they decided to make stationery for me. So they put my name in the yeshiva. And they noticed that on stationery, often it has a mechaber of sforim. So they wrote underneath it, mechaber Torah Min HaShemayim. That's me. They didn't realize who you were talking to today. Mechaber Torah Min HaShemayim. Anyway, so but what this is a very interesting piece of work. It's on each parsha. I think it has a lot of good information. Some you might like, some you might not. And that's, you know, your choice. But what it does is two things. On each parsha, it says like a little Dvar Torah to strengthen the Emunah in Torah Misinai. Just to give another notch, another kvetch, how clear it is to us that the Torah was given by HaKadosh Baruch Hu at Har Sinai. And by repeating it regularly, it has a composite, compounded effect. You know, the parsha is a wonderful, wonderful mechanism. Rabbis use it all the time. You know, the rabbi found out that a couple of his congregants were doing something this week that they shouldn't be doing. And he wants to talk about it. Now, when he talks about it, and they're aware that he knows about it, and he's speaking directly to them, what they usually do is lower themselves down to the seat so the message goes to the guy behind them. Like, you know, it's not for me. We deny it. I don't want it. When he happens to be talking on the parsha, he doesn't know anything. He's not talking to us. It just so happens that he's talking about the parsha. The parsha is like a non-threatening, non-agenda type of format that doesn't get the defense mechanisms up. Because, oh, it happened to be in the parsha. The rabbi's talking from the... Same thing, when they say something from the parsha, it doesn't mean like, I came in here with an agenda. I'm here with an agenda today. That's quite obvious, all right? But I have no agenda. It just so happens in today's parsha, there's a little word I want to tell you. That's much less offensive, that evokes much less defense mechanisms, that evokes much less resistance. So on each parsha, there's a little word, something, some you may like, some you may not, but it doesn't matter. Some are good, some are not, fine. But just something to be machazek emunah. But then there's something else. And I'd like to spend some time talking about both of these things. And that is, we know that one of the educational goals of the Torah chinuch system is to create ma'aminim. We want a generation that will know with clarity, with I like to say beyond any reasonable doubt, and we'll get back to that in a moment, that there was a Torah Sinai, there was a Maimed Har Sinai, there was a revelation at Sinai, and the Bnei Yehudim himself has authored, has given us the Sefer Torah, and this is Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebaal Peh, and this is what we have to this very day. Now, that message is a harsh message. Forgive me. Do you know why it's a harsh message? Why is it a harsh message? Torah Sinai, purpose of creation. Wow, I made it sound so beautiful. There's a purpose. The Bnei Yehudim revealed the purpose himself. What could be better? You know, he did something that evokes resistance. You know what he did? He gave us 613 problems along with this message. Oy vavoyli. Oh, whoa, 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 whoa. What I have to do, the responsibilities of getting up early in the morning, and Shabbos, and Yontif, and davening mitzvahs, and oy. And if you think I'm exaggerating, then you're not in tune with the generation today. Now, to the teachers that are teaching younger grades, they may not be there yet. But as they get to the older grades, it transforms from thrill and pleasure to burden. In the first grade, the sukkah is such a beautiful thing. I make a little sukkah. I make a picture of myself sitting in the sukkah. I take it home. They hang it up in the sukkah. I'm so proud, everybody. Left. By the sixth and seventh and eighth grade, you tell me, oh, you got to eat everything you eat. You can't go. You have to have a sukkah. And you have to eat. Too much. And sukkah is one of the easier ones. But Shabbos. Ooh, Shabbos is wonderful. And isn't so exciting. The first grade, the second grade, the third grade. And the songs at the Shabbos party. I was the Ima. I was the Abba. I don't know how you do it over here. Yeah. But whatever it is. But you get to the older grades. There's a sports game, there's this. I sit around all day long, the long afternoons in the summer, the long nights in the winter. What am I supposed to do with myself? I'm going out of my mind. It's not so poshut. And Shabbos is also maybe one of the easier ones. So a lot of things that are very difficult. 613 burdens. So there's a resistance to Kabbalah, so Malchus Shamayim. You know, the Ramban brings a mechilta. The Ramban in Aseres HaDibros brings a mechilta. And so the Ramban, the Mechilta says like this: Moshe leMelech, he comes to a city, and the people say, Melech, gzor aleinu gzeiros, make rules for us. So the Melech answers like this: Imalchusi iatem mekablim heich tekaimu gzeirosai. If you not first mekabel me as the Melech, the Malchus, you won't be able to keep my rules. What are you talking about? They said, Gzeros. They asked for it. They begged for it. Please, I beg of you, give us rules. Give us Gzeros. Once you know what the gzeiros are, it's very hard to be makabel the malchus shemayim. First be makabel the malchus shemayim. Hashem melech, there is a creator, there is a purpose for creation. Hashem created the world, he created it for a purpose, he gives us that purpose. And then, once I have that appreciation, then I can begin to deal with the gzeiros. Gzeiros are burdensome. They are painful. And as much as we may be comfortable with a life of Torah and mitzvahs, and by the way, not everybody, not every adult our age, even yeshiva educated, is comfortable with the oil hamitzvahs. The oil hamitzvahs is still an oil. We have to be mekabel every day the oil malchus shomayim and the oil mitzvahs twice a day, no matter how old we are, no matter who we are. Because it's not simple. There is resistance. We were created with the Yetzer Hara. The reason we get so much schar is because of the resistance. And we have to recognize that resistance and bypass it. One of the ways to bypass that resistance, I think we find it in very graphically described in the Sefer HaChinuch as to'elis, benefits. Oh, there's something in it for me? Oh... But already, yeah, let me hear. What is it? Oh, there's a burden, but there's a benefit. That's already there's something to talk about. The Sefer HaChinuch writes, I think it's in the mitzvah, it's in Parashas Vayikra, on the mitzvah of Kol Se'or V'Chol Dvash Lo Yisaktiro Ish El Hashem, that we're not permitted to bring on the Mizbeach Se'or, leaven, or honey. And he says, he doesn't know the reason. He wrote, it's a book he wrote for his son, for his bar mitzvah, and he wrote Tam v'Toelas, he calls it, a reason and a benefit for the mitzvahs, and he doesn't have one. On this one, he's confused, and he almost left it alone. He says, but I'm afraid, if I don't give Tam v'Toelas on all of the mitzvahs, then what's going to happen? He says, I'm afraid my son will think that the Torah is a sefer chosum, it's a closed book, and then I quote what he says, and I'm afraid, pen yivatu bohem mitoichkach b'nar yusof, they'll rebel against it in their youth, v'yanichum le'oilom, and forsake it forever. Today the kids are coming back, most of them, you know, this he's talking about, he's afraid they'll forsake it forever, v'yelchu lahevel. They'll join the folly, the foolishness of the world. This is 500 years ago. The world didn't have hevel like we got today. Well, maybe it did. Shlema Melech said the whole was hevel. But anyway, the world today is probably in worse shape. He grew up in the house of one of the Rishonim. He has a father who gave him this book, this bar mitzvah, who explained Tam b'Toelet in every single mitzvah except this one. And this particular one isn't even Lamaisa because there was no Beis HaMikdash 500 years ago. So it's not like he has to come to the Beis HaMikdash every day and say, why can't I bring my Seor and Vash? And he was afraid. If he doesn't give him Tam b'Toelet in one mitzvah, he gave it to him in every other one. He's going to feel the Torah as a Sefer Chosum, and I guess it means he'll use it as an excuse and to reject everything. So Tam v'Toelet is extremely important. And Tam v'Toelet gives us a sense of, I want to believe it. There's benefit. There's benefit. There's something in it for me. And that makes me more ready. It pairs away the resistance, the defense mechanisms, the burden of it, because there's so much benefit. And if you think that this maybe is not nogea today, and this was for little children, and it's for children, that's what, we're dealing with children here. But let me quote to you something else. And this one is so bizarre. The Ralbag, again in the Toelius, says like this. He says, if you wish to convince a loved one means I have the power of love to convince, which we spoke about before, to do something that's bizar umuzar, that's painful and strange, bizarre. What do? First tell him the benefits. Don't tell him what it is. Don't tell him what it is. First tell him the benefits, and the cheshek, he says, for the benefits will mitigate the pain and the strangeness of it. Okay, very nice lesson. Where do we learn it from? It's in Parshas Lech Lecha, from Avram Avinu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not tell Avram Avinu that in this bris that he's making with him, there's a knife involved. He says, if you enter into this covenant with me, you're going to have Deiris and you're going to have Eretz Yisroel. And only then did he say, here's the knife. It's an operation. And Avram Avinu could have been affected in the Shleimus, I assume, the way he did the mitzvah, whether he was told the benefit before or after. Had he given him the knife and then told him the benefit, it wouldn't have been the same thing. Even an Avram Avinu is affected by benefits. How much more so, I'll tell me. So the other thing that we have in this little booklet which we're going to give you is that on most of the parashiyos there's a piece called Benefits and Belief. And that is some way of sharing some of the benefits of the mitzvahs. So we really have a format for strengthening emunah. We have a weekly, if one wishes, or regular, if one wishes, chizuk in a little Dvar Torah, which gives another twist in the clarity of the Torah Misinai, and together with it, or separately, however we choose to do it, we hear a lot about the benefits, so we should want to believe, we should want to accept, we should remove the Yetzer Hara and the defenses against it, because there's something in it for me. But I caution you with one thing. I'm sorry, what? Yes, now again, younger grades, it's hard for me to say. I believe that a lot of this can be adapted for the younger grades. I'm not sure kindergarten, first grade, but by second, third grade, it can be adapted. You know, that's the talent of the young rebbeim, to take Torah concepts and to simplify them in words and in pictures, images, and thoughts that they can understand. So it's probably more of a challenge to do that, but it can be done. And in one sense, it's easier, because they don't have that resistance yet. The younger grades are so pure. They're so innocent. They're so open-minded. They're so open-hearted. They're so receptive. So, and if you get them then, and it becomes clear to them, they're in for life. So it's a critical point that can work. Oh, but there's one thing I want to caution everybody. Unfortunately, a lot of chinuch seems to emphasize the next world. I, at a young age, developed a difficult attitude with the next world. I saw, when I was a young kid, my grandmother was severely burnt by an explosion of a pressure cooker, and she lay in bed for months. And I heard her constantly saying, Oy, in jene Welt, it sei na sehr glücklich. In the next world, it's going to be so happy, it's going to be so wonderful. And I, as a little kid, said, I don't know, you can't wait for the next world. I want it here and now, and that was here and now many years ago. Today, we're not in the here and now, we're in the here and yesterday. You know, that now is too far away. You know, the most instantaneous of instantaneous of instantaneous. People are constantly throwing out the computers because it takes another 30 seconds in order to connect with whatever they want to connect with. So we have to be able to articulate the benefits in this world. And the Sefer HaChinuch does that. I'm not saying all of his benefits we can relate to, but the concept is very good. And we try to do that here too. If they can understand the benefits, and the major benefit in this world is what we mentioned at the very beginning, it's going to bring me happiness. If our Talmidim can appreciate that a life of Torah and mitzvahs, both the learning of Torah and the observance of its mitzvahs, will bring them happiness, they need nothing more. That's the ultimate benefit. And happiness, not only in the next world, and there is a mile to the next world's happiness because it's eternal, and it's the ultimate connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as the Mesillas Yesharim says, and it's without the interference of the goof and all of the desires that we have. But we need it. Kids need it. We need it too in this world. No, most people don't have the patience to wait for Yenevelt, for the other world. So that's, I think, a very critical thing, to be able to articulate the benefits of this world. Now, of course, since Torah and mitzvahs is the purpose of creation, then we can feel good about ourselves because this is our purpose. But we have to be able to inculcate that into the chinuch system so that they feel and they recognize, they appreciate that. Now, yeah, I'm sorry. What's that?
How do you explain?
Okay. So this is a very good question. I'm glad that you asked. Number one, as parents, we have to advise the parents that they have to go out of their way to make the Shabbos special for the kid, not just for them, you know, but for the kid. Meaning, you know, I think one of the Rishonim in the Novi where it says V'karosel Shabbos Oinik says that the Shabbos that's muvdal b'tanugim gashmiim allows the spiritual message to penetrate, and that's reason for all the Oinik Shabbos. But I know this is such a special. I look forward to the meals. I look forward to the food. I look forward to the you know, for us, we look forward to the rest. Shinu b'Shabbos is tanug. That makes it allows the ruchnius to penetrate. For a kid, it has to be things that he enjoys. For example, they should get special toys. They should get special things that they have only for Shabbos. They get special treats that they like for Shabbos. And if they have parsha things to do at the table or whatever you may give out, but it should be with rewards, with this, the favorite candy, the favorite game, the favorite this, the favorite that. So by creating an environment of physical happiness or material happiness on their age level, that is one thing that has to know. But there's something else too. As they get a little bit older, they have to hear about the Shabbos and realize how much their parents and the Rebbeim appreciate it. And know that they may not appreciate it as much because they don't have as many responsibilities. When one has responsibilities, one has burdens, one has challenges, one has problems, one has issues that drive them crazy. So what the Shabbos is not shaykh. I couldn't live without Shabbos. Shabbos is a lifesaver. I would go out of my mind if I had to think about these problems every single day. I get a break and then I can start again. So a kid has to be explained that even though in his world he may not have this pressure, but he has to become appreciative of the Shabbos, because as he grows into it and as he grows in life, he's going to have the kind of pressures that the parents have. And the best way to communicate this is to see it in the family, see it in the parents, or if they come to the Rebbeim, see it in the Rebbeim. What we always make fun of is in the those people that are sitting around Shabbos afternoon and waiting, when can we make Abdullah to go to the movies? You know what I mean? That type of thing. That really sends a negative message. That Shabbos is no good. We got to put up with it. It's a burden that we really don't like, and all we got to do is wait until we can get over with it. It has to be, and also during the week, Shabbos, special clothing, this, whatever it is, we save it for Shabbos. All of these things give a sense of specialness that even a young kid can feel a special. I wanted a certain garment, a certain clothing. Okay, we're going to get it. We're going to wear it on Shabbos. We can do orchestrate a lot of things to make them feel that way. I'd like to, as well. Yeah. Well, okay, so now like this. So first of all, I don't know, but I think there's definitely room for us to educate parents. You know, that if we sense, whether it's on a group level, you know, a lecture for the parents, a class for the parents, or something in writing that's sent home for the parents, or it's, if you notice in a kid, a personal conversation. I would call a parent, you know, if I see the kid, Shabbos has no meaning, I say, you know, I have a suggestion. You have to create this environment. Not that you don't. I wouldn't suggest that they don't, because you turn them off. But, you know, but I give you some aces how to create this environment at home so this kid, it should be contagious. Let him know. Let him see. Let him feel how you feel. Let him identify with how you feel. But you're right. It's a problem. But I'd like to, as long as we're talking about Shabbos, I would like to mention something else. And that is as follows. The message that we implant, even in younger kids who don't fully understand it, reverberates and grows with them as they get older. And let me just share this with you. How do you explain Shabbos? Shabbos has a few... there's something else too. Explaining Shabbos in terms of its menuchas hanefesh is the most beneficial way to explain it. Because what does the world look at? The world, you know, I deal with non-religious people, they say, 24, 25 hours and you can't do anything. How can you live like that? But you have to flip it around. This is 25, 26 hours of tranquility where my world is complete. Allow me to explain. For the Shabbos has a few very unique ingredients. What's that? What's that? What's that? Excuse me, what grade are you?
Eighth grade.
Eighth grade? I would like an invitation to speak to you.
Exactly.
Okay?
Anything.
I will try. I will try. Can't say I'll succeed, but I would try. Okay? Because let me, what?
They want action.
I know they want action, but no, wait. Don't deny them that they want action. Don't deny them the importance of action, but set their sights on a time where they will need this. And even in high school, it starts to come. I got a big test. I got a term paper. I got this. I got that. Boy, at least today I don't have to think about it. And they could hear that there's coming such a time. They could see it in adults and others, and it could have an influence. Well, let me just give you some. Let's say it like this. You expressed how they feel about my speech before I said it. Okay, so let me say it, and then you'll tell me, no, then I'll be ready, very ready to hear how you feel about it, because I agree with you. I know that that's the problem, but let me do what I would do. Number one, I would say like this, listen, life is complicated. Life is difficult. The key to normal living, mental health, and success, menuchas hanefesh and hatzlocha in life, is to develop the midas habitochon. If a person has bitochon, a person can trust in Hashem, there's nothing to worry about. I have super problems, overwhelming problems, but you know something? There's a God in the world. He can do anything. He takes care of everything. He created the world only to do chesed. That's what he does, and that's what he has done, and that's what he will do, and I'm relying on it. I have menuchas hanefesh, and I'm also told that to the degree, the Chofetz Chaim says this beferish in a letter, to the degree that I am able to put my confidence, my trust, my hope, even my hope, let alone my trust in Hashem, it's to that degree that I affect the future, that I affect the results. I can affect results through my reliance on Hashem. Okay, now, Shabbos is a unique opportunity to develop that reliance. Okay? And therefore, I tell my 8th grade class, right now you guys may not be interested in Menuchas HaNefesh, but you probably know very well that life is tough. And as you get older, your parents are shielding you from the difficulties of life. Maybe, maybe not. Some people have experienced tragedy by the 8th grade. You need the ability to cope with the difficulties of life. This is what Shabbos does. Number one, we celebrate creation. Creation has a number of very powerful messages. Number one, there's a creator. That means there's someone in control. Number two, why did he create the world? It's a purposeful act. He created Olam Chesed Yibone. Hashem is all about Chesed. That's all he wanted to do. He needs nothing else b'tachtonim in this world, in the lowly world here, other than to do Chesed. That's his only concern. That already gives me a sense of, wait, it's all about Chesed. That's what he wants. That's all he does. Wow, that's nice. Besides that, there's a creator. There's a purpose. I can have a purpose in my life. I can be happy. Ooh. So Shabbos reminds me every single week, there is a creator. The creator created the world for chesed. He's still actively involved in this creation. I observe this Shabbos every week to testify to that fact. And I can also have a sense of purpose because there's a creation. I can feel good about myself. I'm saying it very fast. Number two, Shabbos is a unique relationship between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael. We say in the Shemoneh Esrei, V'lo nesato Hashem Elokeinu l'goy ha'aretz. What? The other mitzvahs he didn't give to the goyim either. What are you talking about? What do you mean he didn't give Shabbos to the goyim? He didn't give any of the mitzvahs to the goyim. Sheva mitzvahs for Inoach. Shabbos the goyim should have gotten. They taka stole it. They copied it. Some on Friday, some on Sunday. But why should he have given it to them? They too were created. It celebrates creation. They was created as much as I was created. Adam Risha wasn't Jewish. Tell him that. He wasn't. You know? It wasn't Jewish. Sorry, it wasn't. Avraham Avinu was the first Jew. Adam Arisha was Adam Arisha. That was the original plan. So, all the goyim should have been invited. But you know what? Shabbos is a celebration of the anniversary of creation. And we say, the Pasuk says, Beini ubein b'nei Yisrael ois hi le'olam, says Rashi, ois gedoylo shebochart bochem, v'hanchili lochem es yoy menuchosi le'menucha. Shabbos is a great sign of our special relationship that I chose you by only giving you to celebrate my anniversary of creation as a day of Menucha to the exclusion of everyone in the world. Ben Noach Shel Shavas is Chayav Misa. Nobody can interfere with this celebration by invitation only. Otherwise, outside, you don't belong. I don't care where you could be, in Kalamazoo, Michigan. You have no right to do this because this is a private affair. So Shabbos is the greatest expression of the unique relationship between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael. When the whole world should have been invited to this party, He only invited us. So we have a Creator who created the world for Chesed, who gives us a purpose for living, and has a special love for the Klal Yisrael because He chose us to celebrate, no one else. Let's talk for a moment about the nature of this celebration. There's a very unique aspect of the celebration. It's merumas in the Pasuk where it says, Shechis yomim tavoy, v'osisa kol malachtecha. Rashi says, v'osisa kol malachtecha, why does the Torah have to tell me I should do my work? My boss has to tell me to do my work. What's the Torah tell me, v'osisa kol malachtecha? Shechis yomim tavoy. Rashi says, when Shabbos comes, sheyia be'inecho, ke'il kol malachtecha asuyo. Shabbos has the koyach to give me such a total sense of menuchas hanefesh, as if everything is complete. My whole world is done. Everything's taken care of. There's nothing left to be done. Kol malachtecha asuya. Because why? Number one, there's a Creator who's Moli Chesed, who's in control. I don't worry about it. That Creator has a special love for me and takes special care of us. If I close my store, He'll make sure that even though Shabbos is the big business day, or it used to be, I don't know what it is today, but He'll take care of me. And because I'm forbidden to do anything, forbidden at a very heavy, hefty price. Memela, I can't do anything. I can't do anything. There's a Creator in the world. It's as if everything is done. I rely on Him. You know, they tell the story about this rabbi that every Friday afternoon, he goes to the president of the shul and he says, I want to borrow $10,000. I'll return it Motzei Shabbos. And this goes on for months. Every single Friday afternoon. Finally, the president says, Rabbi, listen, I got no problem with this deal. You give me back the money every week, but what does a rabbi do with $10,000 on Shabbos? So he says, you have no idea how much better the sermon comes out with $10,000 in the bank. You know, the money's in the bank. Everything is taken care of. Nothing to worry about. This is the Koyach HaShabbos. And if you wish to describe this, and maybe the kid in the eighth grade, they can certainly hear this, younger grades a little bit, I'll tell you a little story. This is in a poem written by Heinrich Heine. Heinrich Heine was a German poet. I think he was born Jewish. He was a very confused individual, but brilliant. So he writes like this. He says there was a Polish landowner, and he was a nice guy. He used to visit his tenants occasionally to see how they were doing. One Friday night, he comes upon this Jewish family. And he walks in, they welcome him, sit down to the table. They're sitting around the table. They're talking to each other. They're singing. A very beautiful, tranquil atmosphere he sees. It was wonderful. But he noticed that it's leaking in from the ceiling over there and over here. He noticed that the tablecloth was patched. He noticed that the clothing was frayed. He noticed that the food was sparse. And he was taken by the contrast between the level of tranquility, peace of mind, and happiness and the poverty in which they were obviously living. He was so taken that he walks over to the balabos and he says, one wish, anything in the world you wish for, it'll be yours. The balabos could have asked for a new house. The balabos could have asked for a new job. The balabos could have asked for $1 million. The balabos could have asked for a few more wishes. He asked for one thing. Could you be so kind? The candle that's lighting the room is bent and it's dripping very fast and it's going to go out and we won't be able to continue enjoying the Shabbos meal. Could you be so kind as to straighten it out? Now what this Heine had in mind, I don't know and I don't care. But he hopped. He caught what the Shabbos is. This poor Jew couldn't relate to the question of what he's lacking on Shabbos. The only thing he was lacking, forgive me, was the Shabbos going. And even that he wasn't supposed to have, but that's besides the point. He didn't know that. But he couldn't, you know what it means? Not to be able to relate to the question of what I'm lacking? Everything is complete. My world is complete. I have everything. When I bought my first building in Cedarhurst, so I came in Friday night and told my family I'm short $150,000 this week for the closing. But I said, don't worry, the money's in the bank on Shabbos. It's so easy that it goes out after Shabbos. So I decided I'll schedule the closing for Monday. I'll make Havdalah after the closing. Leila, I didn't do that. It worked out anyway. The last minute, someone brought in a check for $150,000. A minute before I went to the lawyer's office. But that's besides the point. But that's it. The money's in the bank. I can't really... What's lacking? What are you talking about? I don't know what you're talking about. There's nothing lacking. Now, they may not appreciate it fully, but they hear that that's a goal. You see, goals are very important to implant, even if they're not ready for them. Because they may not have someone who can inspire them as much as you're inspiring them. And when you plant it, it stays. It reverberates years later. I see in Beis Medrash level how things that they had years ago and they didn't pay attention to and it didn't really register and they don't even remember it. And all of a sudden, something connects. So we can accomplish a lot in that. That's right. You see, because admitting that to them will make them hear it now.
Right.
Admitting that to them, and they'll even hear the benefits now. But
they're not understanding what I'm saying. Because right now they think I'm working because I'm preparing the test for Sunday, so they think I'm working on Shabbos.
Okay. So then you have to explain to them something else. What a tanug it is to learn, and especially to prepare to teach you guys. This is not work. This is the greatest privilege in the world. And that's why I'm allowed to do that. There's so much that could be said. Anyway, but that's to give a sense of benefit of mitzvahs is very, very critical. Okay, can we continue or? Yeah, okay. Let's talk just a little bit, very, very briefly. And I want to maybe refer you now to this book, which I'm going to give you also. It's called Instilling a Lasting Emunah in a Changing Generation. And the table of contents here, I think, is very, very significant. And I really strongly recommend everybody look at the table of contents and to see those things that are relevant to you. Developing a relationship with students, the true source of happiness, we discussed about the purpose of creation, the meaning of mitzvahs, the truth of Torah Mi-Sinai, dealing with resistance, and then a number of other relevant topics. We have to talk for a moment about the truth of Torah Mi-Sinai. Both in this book and in this book, you have readings about that. And there is so much that's been published today. Just recently, Rabbi Gottlieb, Dr. Gottlieb, from a major lecturer, philosopher from Or Sameach, very, very choshev yid. So he came out with a book. It's called Reason to Believe. And in the first four chapters, he goes so thoroughly through the basics of Emunah, of you know, Klal Yisrael, of Maimon Har Sinai, very, very strong. Then he elaborates in more detail, more depth in the rest of the book. But it's an excellent, excellent work. And there are a lot of other things. Kellerman's book, Permission to Receive. I think that's the blue one, not the red one. I don't know, maybe he changed the colors. I don't know, it's from years ago. But it also has a lot of very, very powerful information. But we want to be able to convey to our students the truth of Maimon Har Sinai. Now, the worst way to convey truth is to say to me, I'm going to prove something to you. The minute I stand here and say, I will prove something to you, your first reaction is, come on, admit it. It's a three-letter sentence. No, you won't. That's our first. That's a natural human reaction. I'm going to prove to you. And the stronger that I say I'm going to prove to you, the stronger that you're committed, no, you won't. That's human resistance. That's a defense mechanism. We don't want to be proven anything. We don't want to be... And truth is the most... A scary word in the dictionary. I once did an informal study, very informal. I mean, you laugh. But in a junior high school in San Diego, you know, a day school, junior high school. And I had a discussion with the kids. There's maybe about 30 kids there. And I asked them, just mention for me different traits of character. And they mentioned for 10, 15 minutes every trait of character except for one. Emes, truth. It took the principal finally to mention that one. Nobody wants to think about truth. Without truth, I could do whatever I please in this world. If I'm up against the truth, everything changes. It's the ultimate pressure. It's the ultimate threat. It's the ultimate fear. So we got to be very careful. We're not proving truth. We're not proving anything. Secondly, besides not proving, we don't want people to think that they have to be convinced of everything beyond the shadow of a doubt. Beyond the shadow of a doubt is a dangerous concept. You know why? If I attempt to convince someone of something beyond the shadow of a doubt, then I have cursed that individual to see shadows for the rest of his life. What about aliens from outer space? What about this? And what about that? And what about... You can go nuts. The only criteria for truth in this world is beyond reasonable doubt. And it's very important early on, not saying first grade, I don't know, but someplace there, that people learn that, and you got to be careful in the younger grades, I'll tell you in a moment, but people learn a criterion for truth. How do we judge truth? If they want to know whether something is true, you have to have some criteria to judge it by. Maybe on an older grade, and I'm not sure where, and I'm not even sure, but the real formula is you have to be as sure that something is true as you are that your mother is your mother. Now, don't do that in the early grades because they may go home and really believe that they were adopted. In fact, I had once, and my kids used to come to these Arachim seminars that we put on, and one day I walked down, I see my daughter, she must have been 7 or 8 at the time, she's looking through some of my papers in my study. I said, what are you looking for? She said, I'm looking for my adoption papers. She wasn't adopted, but she's married today anyway, so you don't have to worry about it. But she was really had this worry that maybe she was adopted. But you know something? We know that our mother is our mother. We know beyond reasonable doubt. It's not beyond the shadow of a doubt. There are people, every 10 years you hear a story that somebody was exchanged in the hospital. Could have happened. That's enough. We take medication beyond reasonable doubt that it's going to kill us. We drink water beyond reasonable doubt that it's going to be poison. We go in a car beyond reasonable doubt that we're going to make it to our destination. That's all. There's nothing. That is the ultimate criteria for truth. Very important. Without a criteria. Now, we want to convey truth. We mentioned before that in order to convey truth, we have to... Prior to hearing the truth, people have to have a motivation to listen to the truth. That motivation, it doesn't prejudice them in favor of the truth. It balances the prejudice against the truth. Because we all have prejudice against the truth, because truth is limiting. The truth of Torah says you have 613 responsibilities, plus a million more details that we have in Shulchan Aruch. So we're already against it. So we have to counterbalance that. But there's benefits. Now your mind becomes open, ready to listen. In fact, you know, the Gemara says, Emes V'yatziv D'Oraisa. Saying Emes V'yatziv every day seems to refer to the whole parasha there. Is the Raisa. Why do we say in Emes V'yatziv? V'yatziv v'nochum v'kayom v'yoshor v'ne'amon. Truth. V'ohuv v'choviv v'nechmod v'noyim v'noyro. I don't know how that got in there. V'adir m'sukon v'kubol v'toy v'yofe. Every day we are told that we have to repeat again. The Torah is true. Kabbalah Samach Hashraib is true. And it's beautiful. And it's beneficial. And it's nechmod v'yofe v'noyim. Every Jew needs to remind himself this. The Vilna Goyim said this, and the Rambam said this, and I assume the Amoroyim, it comes from Anshei Knesset Gedola, I don't know. So, why? Because we need that chizuk. So it's Emes V'yatziv, it's Nechmod V'noyim, and that's what the Torah is. Okay, now, how do we deal with this Emes V'yatziv part? What can we do? Now, here we have to be very careful. The strength of the argument can be its failure. Strong speaking produces resistance. That's one of the big challenges I have in life. Because I speak strong and you get a lot of resistance. Then you tell a couple of jokes so you break the resistance. But that's besides the point, you know. Have to warm them up. But Lemaisa, speaking strong. In fact, when people say, oh, I wish I was charismatic, I'd be able to... Charisma is a maila and a chesaron. It's a maila to get attention. It's a chesaron to get resistance. Ah, they're doing a number on me. Oh, they got an agenda. That's why I said the Parsha is a little bit easier, because there's no agenda. It just so happens it's in the Parsha. So it's gentle, soft. I used to use the, I don't know if it's used today, but in my days, there was a saying. A funny thing happened to me on the way to the office. It's like, just happened. I don't have an agenda. I'm just coming and telling you, you know, some strange thing that happened. That's one piece. But we need a lot more. Because the threat of truth is neirav oyam. And I would like to suggest that, again, this is a more sophisticated thing. Not that sophisticated, but, you know, a little, maybe the older grades. But before we even talk about Maamar Har Sinai, you know, there's a very interesting curiosity in the history of the world. There happen to be five religions, to the best of my knowledge, that claim that there was a divine revelation to a nation. God appeared to an entire nation. Five religions. They happen to be Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Sikhism, and Baha'i. And I have no idea what they're all about. But you know what's very interesting? They all claim that it happened to the Jews at Sinai. That I would even throw it in one day and leave it alone, not even discuss it, talk about something else, and the next day come back. You know, it just occurred to me, we mentioned this strange thing yesterday. Why, number one, didn't they make a claim that it happened to them? Why doesn't Christianity say that they had public miracles and public revelation? Why doesn't Islam say that Muhammad had this public revelation rather than a dream in the middle of the night and what the historians say was the middle of an epileptic fit? Like, why? Why? I would go back to talk about something else. So now, there's a strange phenomenon, and I have a question why they didn't make this claim. And if some kid will come up, could be even a kid who may even think it's not so bright, you know, could come up with this, I got it! You know what the answer is? You can't make such a claim unless it actually happened. Let's take this audience here. We don't have 1 million people here. We don't have 2 million people here. We don't have 500,000 people here. We don't have 1,000 people here. We don't even have 100 people here. I don't want to go lower than that right now. But not when it's being recorded. Anyway, but Lamaisa, let's say I come into you and I tell you, on the way driving over here this morning, there was traffic stopped, and there was this divine-looking spaceship that came straight down from heaven, and 1,000 little men with long pears and talus cotton came out, and they were blowing a shofar and dancing around, each one of them wearing tefillin, and they were saying that they stopped me, they banged on my car, and they said, we want you to go now and to tell people that we're going to start a new religion, and this is what it is, and so forth and so on. That's what happened to me this morning. Now, the truth of the matter is, you people are a sophisticated group, and you're not going to believe it. There might be a person who can believe it. But you can't disprove it. You cannot be sure that this didn't happen. You could be sure in your mind, but you can't know. And in a court of law, you couldn't testify it didn't happen because you weren't there. Maybe it did. Now, I do the same thing. I say, Rabbi Yisai, did you see what just happened? The clock jumped from hanging on the wall over there to right on top of the Aron Kodesh. This shtender that I have over here was doing a kazatska in the middle of the room. Every table got up and switched places with the other table with the chairs. And the people were hanging by their feet from the rafters. All of you! This happened to all of you just now. Now I want you to go home and tell your families the unique experience that you had today. You know for sure that it didn't happen because you were there. You might be able to convince people that something happened to you, a private revelation. You cannot convince a group of people, even a group of this size, let alone a group of millions of people in the entire nation, that they experienced a revelation, a miraculous revelation, unless it actually happened. And not only did they experience it, They wrote it down in eyewitness form, because the Torah repeats probably 50 times, Atem Re'isim, Kibin HaShemayim, Dibarti Imochim, you saw, Zechor Al Tishkach, Ma'asheru Ei Necho, and so forth and so on. It's written in the form, not that it happened, but that you saw it, and I pass it on to the next generation. And we pass it on to this very day. So, there's nothing like this in the world. You can't get away with this thing as a hoax unless it actually happened. That's why the best these religions can do, I'm getting too excited, see, that's no good. That always happens to me. No, calm, calm. That maybe that's why that these religions, they actually copy what we have. When every time I go into a hotel, I open up the drawer and I see the Gideon Bible, and I notice that they have Exodus, and they have the whole story of Maimon Har Sinai there. Why is it? Well, I'll tell you why. They cannot make up such a story for themselves, because no one's going to believe it. Now they're going to come and say there was a private revelation. Who's going to believe that? That's ridiculous. No, we see God reveals himself. There was a public revelation that everybody knows about. Now maybe we can get away with a private revelation too. That's the best we could do. I lost it again. Calm down. But so these are the ideas that we have to get across gradually, quietly. And this is just the beginning. This is just the beginning. Just the tip of the iceberg. But eventually our Talmidim have to get the sense. And there's really two ingredients. One is testimony. Testimony is very, very powerful. Testimony means there was eyewitness testimony to the events, the miracles in Mitzrayim, which made the Onoichi Hashem Elokecha a very serious thing, because I'm the one, I identified myself already, and now I'm telling you why I did it, and I'm revealing myself publicly to you. The second ingredient is that I spoke directly to Moshe Rabbeinu, so everything he teaches about the Torah Shebichsav, which he's going to write down, which I'm going to dictate to him, and everything he teaches about the Torah Shebaalpeh, which I'm going to teach him, is all from me, because I said, Hinei onoichi bo elecha ba'av he'onon, ba'avur yishma ha'om v'dabri imoch v'gam b'chay amin olaylam. The Torah says that they heard Moshe Rabbeinu being appointed as the official spokesman. So now we know that. Now, very important to cut the heaviness of the atmosphere. And this is heavy stuff. This is threatening stuff. This is scary stuff. This is the kind of stuff that changes my life, that limits, that ties my hands. I'm now obligated to all of these mitzvahs because I know beyond any reasonable doubt, not beyond a shadow of a doubt, because then I'll always be doubting it for the rest of my life. I'll be seeing shadows. But beyond any reasonable doubt, I know that there's a Bnei Olam. The Bnei Olam gave the Torah. By the way, you don't have to prove the existence of Hashem. What you have to show is that the Creator gave the Torah at Har Sinai, and He's the one who controls history, He's the one who controls nature, He's the one who controls the survival of this Torah and the survival of the Klal Yisrael. So, if you don't know exactly who He is, address your prayers to whom it may concern. But He's the one. You don't have to prove the Metzios Hashem, that's too complicated. But Torah Har Sinai is a reality. But you want to cut the heaviness in the atmosphere. So, I do that. I tell a story about a Rabbi Davis. I think he's a retired Rov in Hollywood. What?
Why so afraid of defendants?
What's that? No, my point to you was, and I'm glad that you mentioned it again, is that MS is threatening. Because when there's MS, it doesn't give me any room to do what I please. When there's MS, it doesn't give me any room to indulge my kindness. When there's MS, it doesn't give me any room to say, right now I'm not in the mood. Right now I don't want to get up on time. Right now this, right now that. There's an MS! Scary. Now, see, the problem is this. We have the same problem that the Rebbe in the back had with his kids with Shabbos. You people don't understand what I'm talking about. You know why? Because you're comfortable with the Torah. You're happy with the Torah. You know all of this. You know the benefits. Therefore, you're not threatened by the others. You're talking chinuch. You want to initiate them into this matzah. You want to bring them into where you're holding now. For them, and this is a pachad. That means I must do this, I must do that, I must do that. Kids don't want to do must do this, must do that. There's no must do except what I want to do. There's no such thing as I must do. It's only I want to do. It's only kaiva. It's not obligation. So therefore, that's scary. So that's what you have to, okay? That's the point. I'm very happy you made that point again because that's critical. Now, I tell the story about this Rabbi Davis, who told me once that when he used to invite he invited like a chassidish sofer to his community to fix his Sifrei Torah every couple of years. So the sofer once told him that the Reform rabbi also asks him to come to fix his scrolls. So the sofer said, he once asked the Reform rabbi, what do you need a guy like me for? Like, what's going on over here? So the rabbi said to him like this, those scrolls are the only genuine thing I have in this whole temple, and I want to make sure they stay that way. Here we are 3,300 plus years from Maimon Har Sinai, and here you got a rabbi who don't believe in nothing, and has mamish, they violates Kol HaTorah Kula, but the scrolls are genuine, and they can't be changed, and they can't even have a mistake, and if there's a letter missing, I want to fix it, and if there's a slit in one of the letters, I want the sefer to change. That can't, and it has never changed. Sifrei Torah are identical in Teman, who were probably separated the Jews in Teman for close to 2,000 years. They came back to Eretz Yisrael. Again, I'm getting excited. All they could find was one difference. Besides Chaseiris, and Yaseiris was that Suadaka spelled with an A instead of an Aleph, or an Aleph instead of A. I don't remember which one. The whole difference. It's mind-boggling. No, it's mind-boggling. No, it's very interesting. That's a better word. It's very interesting. Don't get excited. It's very interesting, you know. But when you break it up with something a little bit, oh, the rabbi, the reform rabbi, this, you get the focus off the resistance and makes it easier to deal with. Okay, let me just continue for just another couple of moments and then we'll, whatever we're supposed to do. And I must compliment everyone and say I'm very impressed with, you know, letting somebody stand up here for 2 hours screaming and yelling and just, you know, just putting up with it. Must train them well over here. Anyway, so just one more nakuda, and then we'll have to leave it at that. And that is basically the case of for Torah Mi-Sinai is built on two things, and that is one is of course testimony that we mentioned. And by the way, there is a very good treatment of these topics in here and here and in so many other works. And I strongly recommend that people read them on their own and review them on their own, so they become so much a part of my repertoire that I can access it almost in my sleep, instantaneously. And a kid asks a question, and I already, I'm so familiar with these things that it just flows naturally, without, you know, too much fanfare. Anyway, there's testimony, but there's also evidence. The Gemara in Chulin says in Daf Samach, when it talks about all the simonim of the animals that Moshe Rabbeinu knew. And it says that it says Otu Moshe Rabbeinu Kenigi Hoyo or Blistery Hoyo. Was Moshe Rabbeinu a zoologist or a hunter or I don't know what, something like that? Exactly what that means. Elo Mikan Tshuva LeOimer Ein Torah Min HaShemayim. This is the tshuva to anyone who would say Ein Torah Min HaShemayim. What does that mean? What it means is as follows. Torah Min HaShemayim, we know because it was given by Messiah. There were millions of eyewitnesses. It was passed down as eyewitness testimony to this very day. When I gave a seminar once in Los Angeles, there was standing on the wall there a woman, and she started to ask questions, and she wasn't standing on the wall. She was standing against the wall. Anyway, and she started to ask questions, and I said, it looked to me like she didn't understand what was going on. And I said, wait a minute. Let's assume you were a judge in the California court system. And everybody started to laugh. I said, what are you laughing? She was a judge. You know, it's a high-up judge there, something, I don't know. So I said, well, that's perfect. I've been waiting for that. What do you say about this case? And I explained to her. She says, I must tell you, with far less evidence than you have presented, in my courtroom, it would be decided that you prove the case beyond reasonable doubt. With far less than we presented. So testimony is the name of the game. But there's also evidence. What's the evidence? How could any human author have known what's going to happen in the future? The Torah is full, Tanakh is full of prophecies of the future. Prophecies that have taken place in history. In all other religions, you'll find that prophecy is due and payable in the next world. It's much safer that way. Nobody can disprove it. But here you have full prophecies of there's going to be a churban, a churban, by a srishin, a churban, by a sheni, a golus, the extent of the golus eventually returning to Eretz Yisrael, the suffering, everything is there. So we have to, and scientific information beyond Shemitah with so many other things, all kinds of scientific information, even down to the fact that, you know, until 1990, science believed that the sex of an embryo is determined at the moment of conception. And of course, Chazal say that until 40 days you could be mispala for a zohar. So but science disagreed. In 1990, they came out with a study in the journal Nature in Great Britain that they figured out that it's true that there's a genetic determination with the XY chromosome distribution at the moment of conception, but the actual development as male or female is only finalized around the 42nd to the 48th or 47th day. So they asked him, this was the New York Times reported, so they asked some Torah scholar what he thought about the difference, you know. So he says, well, science is catching up. You know, so there's so much information no human being could have known. So there's testimony and there's evidence. The two together combine. Now, what's recommended really is over a period of a year or over a period of 7 or 8 years, if our kids hear from time to time, often enough, not too often, different pieces of information, both scientific information, both the prophetic information, both testimonial information, and interdispersed with the benefits, then we can create, we can develop, we can inspire a generation of true ma'aminim. I just would like, before I conclude, just to mention one or two things which I just think are so critical and we just didn't get around to discussing them. Number one, as much as we spoke about the tone being subdued, that when it comes to talk about truth, to talk about mitzvahs, to influence, when it comes to learning, it has to be an excitement, an interactive learning experience which excites kids. If you can get kids jumping up and down or raising their hands or whatever, screaming out or whatever you can do, you made it. A Rebbe once told me, a Cheder Rebbe in Yerushalayim, I had my kids there for the summer. So I was going back and he saw the kid was going back to the United States and he had Rachmonis on the kid. He says, I want to teach you, you know, how you teach Torah. So he says, it makes no difference whether you're teaching Aleph Beis or Rambam. That was like the highest thing. It's Lulei Toirosho Shashuoi. It has to be a delight. It has to be fun. It has to be exciting. It has to be, he didn't say, but it has to be challenging. Challenging involves. Ben Franklin said, tell me I'll forget, show me I'll remember, involve me I'll understand. And understanding is exciting. And we have to, it's constantly an ongoing fight and battle and get the kid feels good. He said something, feels good about himself. He asked a question, he got an answer. You know, that was the Beis Halevi's fort. He said about him learning with his son, Chaim Brisker. Chaim Salvi says, neither of us can enjoy it. He says, normally when you learn, you ask a good kasha, and the other one gives a teretz. He says, I ask a kasha, but my son Chaim shows me that it's no kasha. He didn't have hanoah, he didn't say a teretz, I didn't have hanoah, I didn't ask a kasha. So nobody has hanoah. It should be hanoah, it should be exciting. That's what it meant. Then I just want to leave you with two more concepts, which, well, they're connected, really. We must inspire our students to have a yachas, a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That concept is so missing today. So many people say, I don't know, what's this, a relationship with Hashem? How could I have a relationship? I talk to him, yeah, but he don't talk back. He does talk back. You know how he talks back? Behashgocha protis. Introduce them to Hashgocha protis. Let them see from big to small Hashem's involvement in every aspect of our lives. And then they will see, I can have a relationship. I talk to him, he talks to me. He responds to me. He responds in actions that speak louder than words. And the more they discover, and I can tell you so many stories, we don't have the time now, but the more you teach a person to look for Hashgocha Protis, the more they will strengthen their own emunah because they will discover it in every day, in every aspect of their existence. So anyway, that's I think all we have time for right now. And some ideas, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu should help. That in this work that you're doing, which is the holiest of missions that exist in the world today, Hashem should help, and Yehi Rotzon Shetishra Shechina B'Maaseh Yadeichem.